Today, on Shipment from Shiloh, I get some great advice for new Netrunner players from Greg, David, Jake, and Ross. Then, we evaluate basic deck building decisions. Finally, we weigh the pros and cons of Netrunner's most quintessential economy card. All this and more on Shipment from Shiloh. What's good, my runners, and welcome to Shipment from Shiloh, a Netrunner community podcast. I'm your host, Graham, and we're putting on a special beginner episode today with my buddies Jake.
How's it going?
Greg.
Hey, everyone.
And David.
Hey, everybody.
Today's episode is all about beginners to Netrunner. So if you are a veteran, this is the episode of this podcast that you want to send to the new player you just taught, the people who just showed up at your local game night, anyone that you want to encourage to play more. Now, if you are indeed a new person, hello! Welcome to Netrunner. It's a fantastic strategy game that can appeal to a wide variety of gamers. It's a really great game, and you should play it.
It's the argument I've ever heard.
Best argument. Hands down, everyone's playing Netrunner now because of what I just said. So, hopefully, if you're a new player, you've played through several games. Maybe you've played as each side a couple times, tried out some of the factions. Maybe you've mostly just played with the revised core set, or maybe you're using someone else's cards. But in either case, we've got some general tips for you in our first segment called Levy University. Okay, so let me just open up the floor. What is something that you struggled with when you were first playing Netrunner, and what did you learn from that? How did you get better?
I think the big thing with Netrunner is especially I always had, when I first started playing, I understood the runner side of the game, but then once you learn the corp side of the game, my play improved greatly a lot. The way the economy works on the corp side is understanding that, I think, the exchange rate. So I pay 6 for a Fairchild 3, but it makes you lose a turn. That was worth it, even though I got to click for credits the next turn, for example.
Right, right. What advice would you have for a new person in that regard?
Whenever I teach someone the new game, I always teach them the corp side first, because I think once you understand the corp side, you really can really understand the runner side of the game.
Interesting.
Because that is the most interesting thing to me about Netrunner. And it's hard to me, Netrunner is an economy game. So you're trying to figure out I pay this to make you lose that. Is that exchange ultimately worth it? So if it's to keep you out of a server, for example, or if it's just to make you pay a lot to get in.
Sure.
In understanding to a new player that, you know, you can let them into R&D, but maybe it costs them the whole turn to get in there once. And they may steal an agenda, but you set them back, so.
Right. And if they're broke now you know you can jam in your more valuable agenda because you've opened up the scoring window. The runner spent all their money on one run, and they're not going to be able to bounce back in time to steal this agenda on your next turn.
Now it's back to basics again. There's a window when people are actually clicking for credits again. It's a great time to start playing.
Yeah.
I also think agree with that. In some of my early corp games, I probably still wait until I think there's like 0% chance the runner can get in. And I think you lose a lot of games playing that way.
Yeah.
Because it takes a lot of time and like money to try and create a scenario where like there's literally no chance the runner gets in. I think sometimes you just have to say, like, they might see the top card of R&D this turn, and that's okay. Or they might steal this agenda, but they're going to spend 10 or all of their credits or whatever trying to steal it, and that'll give me another opportunity to score right after it. I think it takes a long time as the corp to, like, feel okay with possibly losing points, because you don't have to win a perfect game, and that's fine. You just have to win the game if you're trying to play.
That's hard to learn. the sort of evaluating the risk and deciding if it's worth it or not to jam in an agenda or something.
When I first started playing, I always felt like the corp came more naturally to me than the runner. Something I really struggled with as the runner was that I just didn't know what to do. Because you can literally just spend all of your clicks running on different servers and checking HQ 4 times or going to R&D 4 times. And what's most difficult is learning to manage, okay, I want to put early pressure on the corp to make sure they just can't get set up and run away with the game. But I also don't want to waste my clicks instead of playing econ cards or getting set up, just running on servers that probably aren't going to have agendas. So I think it's that trickiness of trying to balance how much you want to spend getting set up and how much pressure you want to put on the corp early on.
What advice would you give to a new person who didn't know how to balance between setting up and running in the early game?
Thinking about it from the corp's perspective is really helpful because that makes you able to sort of read the other player, and you can say as the runner, okay, they install an unprotected remote on turn one. Agenda in most decks, probably not. So maybe it's not worth running there, especially if it's Jinteki and it could be a trap. And so learning to kind of read those cues makes you better informed when you go to do those decisions. But there's also that element of bluffing, which can keep things interesting. And so there's no real way to always know what exactly you should do, but you can make an educated guess. And it helps to think about it from the other perspective.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about money, too, because I think as a new player, it's easy to feel like you're broke all the time because you have all these cards. They cost all this money, and so you install it all. But if you do install everything, or if you do res all your ice as the corp, then you're going to be flat broke, which means that you can't make runs or score agendas. So what advice do you have for a new player if they are having fun playing, but they feel like they're broke all the time?
So my advice, which took me months and months to learn, is that try not to go below 5 credits unless you are playing econ cards that are going to give you money like dripping at the beginning of each turn. Because what I found myself in many, many situations, more than I'd like to admit, is I install all these cards. I have no money to use any of the programs or anything or any of the assets if I'm the corp. And then I'll draw a sure gamble or a hedge fund, and then have to spend the next 2 turns clicking up to 5 credits in order to play that card to go up to 9.
Yeah.
Sure, you have this base and never depleting that unless you absolutely have to in like a must-win situation.
Yeah, definitely. Or, if you're sitting on an econ card in your hand, I'm thinking of something like Celebrity Gift on the corp side costs 3. So if the martyr is making a run, and you have the option to res a piece of ice, but it's going to bring you below 3, maybe you don't want to do it then. You know, you have to evaluate, like, okay, is it worth it for them? Like, if they're just running R&D, is it worth it for them to get this random access off of my deck, knowing that I would then lose clicks, I would then lose tempo the next turn, clicking up for credits instead of being able to play this really good economy card that I have?
That being said, I think on the corp side, it's a little bit more okay to be low on credits, because like once you've rezzed a piece of ice, it'll do its job regardless of how much money you have.
Yeah.
So I think it's more damning to like go down to 0 as a runner and then try to like waste an entire turn and a half to play your next econ card, whether that's like Sure Gamble or Liberated Accounts or something similar. The corp, at least, like, you'll be clicking for credits, which never feels good to just spend a turn trying to get money. But at the very least, you're like, ice will still do its job if it's already rezzed.
Right.
So early game, that's awful. But once you have a few pieces up, it feels a little less bad than as the runner when I install something and go down to, like, exactly 0 credits. And
then that's sort of how I view the corp, too. You want to build up your money base so that you have it available so that you can res all of your assets and ice when you need it. Once they're up, like you said, you don't really have that need for a ton of money because you've already invested it in those cards that are now doing their part.
I've always been a shaper player at heart, and so I love ways I can start my turn just with drip economy, for example, daily casts, underworld contacts, data folding. That's where I go for my economy usually. So.
I think the advantage of that kind of money is that you're not spending more clicks on it, which then means that you have more agency over how you're spending your actions.
It's still very slow, though, so.
It is very slow, so that's the drawback, right? But I think most of the time runners want at least some source of slower money that will last all game, because it shores up that late game inevitability that the game's kind of built around, right? Like if a game lasted 100 turns, the runner would win every time, right? Because eventually they will always have enough money and all of their breakers down so that they can afford to get into any remote and steal whatever it is that they want.
The corp would be decked out if it went 100 turns.
Well, that's true. So maybe that's a terrible example. What if the game went 41 turns? No, but the point being that the runner will ultimately win unless the corp does something about it. And to hasten to get to that point where the runner is definitely going to win, the runner can put in those kinds of drip economy cards that you're talking about, David.
And as the runner, I think you have to make a value assessment. So let's say the corp installs a card and you're fairly certain that's an agenda, cost you 15 credits to go in. The corp is at 0 points, so you don't really care if they score two. It's probably not worth draining all of your money to go in and steal that one agenda unless it's going to win you the game. Because you really just don't want to spend your money on things that aren't critical if it's going to really slow you down later on.
I
And
think
that
that
was
one
one of my things.
statement is key, what you just said. If you spend money now, it's not worth it if it's going to like cause you to need to catch up later.
Tell you how many times I've made a run to steal, what turned out to be a 1 or 2 point agenda, and it just bankrupted me, and it allowed the corp to have like a 4 turn scoring window where they could score out 3 or more points.
I think my tip for someone who is new to the game and feels poor all the time is to not spend your money until you need it. So if you are the runner, that means like if you've got a bunch of 3 and 4 and 5 cost parts of your rig, don't install those things until you need them. With the exception maybe being icebreakers some of the time, but like if you don't need the memory from your console and you're not going to use the ability that your console is going to give you yet, don't install it yet. If you've got an HQ interface in your hand, but you're not going to run HQ yet, then don't install the HQ interface. It costs 4. That's a chunk of change, And similarly on the corp side, kind of that concept I mentioned earlier, like don't res ice until you need to res it. Because if you can keep your cash liquid, if you can keep your credit pool high, then even though you've got a couple unresed pieces of ice on your centrals, maybe you can still jam out an agenda because that way, and you have enough money to res all that ice that's on your scoring remote. Which maybe you wouldn't have had that money if you had spent a bunch of money resing ice on R&D just to slow them down from getting a single access off the top, right?
I think the counterpoint to that, as well, is if you're the runner and you find yourself, maybe you mulliganed and you just drew 5 bad starting cards. If you're low on credits, and you suspect that the corp may be trying to hide some agendas, base checking the ice early on to force them to drain their money pool, resing that ice, especially if it turns out to be expensive, because that can level the playing field a little bit, even if you can't get through or you might take a few net damage. You take away that huge money advantage that they would have had otherwise.
Right. So
Pour as
if,
much as you can.
maybe the corp starts off and they like click for some credits and install a piece of ice in front of HQ. Maybe your first click is just to run that piece of ice. And if it's a rota turret or a Victor or another piece of ice that would maybe do some damage to you, if you're running early on in your turn and you don't have any programs installed yet, then like, what's the worst it's going to do? Usually it's what you said, Jake, it's take a couple net damage, but like, you're not going to trash a program if you don't have any programs installed. Ah,
right.
Smart.
And that's definitely something I've learned more recently, is to basically just ask myself every time, like, what's the worst that could happen? Like, I definitely don't know every card in the game, but I generally know, like, the kinds of abilities cards might have. And so I say, like if this card has, like, some trash-related functionality, am I in a spot where I can recover from trashing something on my board right now, right? Hmm. Or I have literally nothing down, which I feel like is often the case if you're using, like, Paperclip or other cards you can play from archives.
Sure.
So, like, I'm just going to run, and will probably tell me to end the run, and that's okay because I have nothing else to trash on my board. But right. I think I've learned to try to start pressuring the corp a little earlier. It is okay if you don't have to set up your entire like rig or like ideal. I have all three icebreakers plus a console down before I start running in the game. And that's something I'm trying to get better at, is recognizing that.
Yeah. I think that's something that's common amongst new players, because that's the safest way, right? Like, I'm just going to wait till I have 10 credits and all of my breakers down, and then I'm going to start running. But if you're not giving any pressure to the corp, then they can just start jamming out and set up their board however they want, and you're not making them spend any money because they're not resing any ice. So I think that's generally a bad tactic if you wait until your whole rig is set up before you start running.
And when a corp is deciding whether to res ice or not, you know, we've talked about it, you know, it's important to look at what the ice does and see if it's going to make an impact. If it's, like you said, if it's trash a program and the runner has no programs, there's no point in resing it. But another piece of information that I didn't realize when I first started playing is that when you res a piece of ice, you show the runner what type of ice it is, which allows them to install the breaker that they need if they have it, or if they have a special order that allows them to go search for it. If you don't res it, they won't have that information. So if it's a non-critical situation, let's say you have like no agendas, or you only have one agenda in HQ, maybe you don't res it so you can have that element of surprise later on, as well as saving your money.
Yes, 100%. You know, we're talking a little bit about ice. How do you guys like to build servers? Where do you like to put your ice? How do you like to arrange your ice, and what kind of ice do you put where?
Fairchild 3 that just do a lot of nasty subs that don't end the run, those tend to go over HQ archives or R&D, because it's got a good exchange rate to get through that kind of stuff. So
yeah, I think the ice that's expensive to get through, either with a breaker or without, but doesn't stop them, that's the kind of stuff you want to put on your centrals, right? Because they're never running to get an agenda. They're running for a chance of getting an agenda. Whereas like your scoring remote, if you've got install double advance, like probably 9 times out of 10, that's going to be an agenda, right? So that's where you really want your, like your big ice and your costly end the run ice.
Otherwise it's got to just be taxing. So,
right.
Like, I'll say with the NGO front now, it might only be a 5 out of 10 that a double advanced card is actually an agenda.
NGO is pretty great. It's an advanceable asset that if you've got a couple advancement counters on it, you can pop it at what we call instant speed, which means that you can res it and use its ability without needing to spend a click. And it gives you money back. If you're trying to score out of a traditional scoring remote, it's really good because it is an economy card that also doubles as sort of a trap to bait them through that remote and make the runner spend a bunch of money.
Then the corp gets 8 credits.
Yes, 8 credits if it's double advanced, 5 if it's single advanced.
Always feels bad when the runner wins and they did it by like only running R&D or like only running centrals, basically, right?
Right.
Like, you feel like you played a normal Netrunner. Like, I put a card down in a remote server, and they weren't able to steal it, and I got my 2 or 3 points. But they just, like, keep running my deck and just get all 7 points that way. So I agree that it's good to put like taxing, but not necessarily like end the run ice over R&D. But if you notice that like their whole strategy is around ignoring your remotes, like they really basically don't care what you're putting in your remote because they feel like they're ahead of you, whether that's like economy wise or they got a better draw than you did. It's definitely not like Netrunner has like very few hard and fast rules, I guess I would say. It is okay if once you like noticed what your opponent is doing more often than not to try and counter that.
I think a lot of our advice is based off of just trying to predict what your opponent is on. And although there are patterns and there are common things, it doesn't necessarily mean that, if you're playing against a criminal, that they're only going to hit HQ. Just because criminals are good at HQ runs doesn't mean that it's not gonna, it doesn't mean that Gabe's not gonna run a surprise three indexing and he's gonna just be savage on your R&D.
We'll say if I'm playing Shaper and I have end the run ice in my opening hand, it is going to go on R&D.
Yes. Why?
Just for the Maker's Eye indexing, all of that multi-access stuff that they can pull off on turn one.
Yeah.
Would it be good to talk about like I'm setting across a ID that's from this faction? What are the general thoughts I have?
Sure.
Because we've already covered kind of Shaper and Criminal so far.
So if you're sitting across from an Anarch player, and I'm thinking mostly like revised core set cards, although also, some of the more popular stuff in the current meta. What are you thinking if you're sitting across from a Reyna or an Ed Kim or an Alice? Well, Alice is a bad example because her ID ability says like run archives all the time. So, if you're sitting across from an Ed or a Reyna, what do you do?
I was just going to say, I don't know if I'd really have a strong preference unless I knew sort of what the deck was trying to do. No, I think it would depend on the agendas that I had in hand.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think if I had more than one agenda, I would lean towards icing up HQ first. Otherwise, I would probably ice up R&D, right? Because everyone's had the experience where it's like you leave your R&D open because you're like, yeah, it's fine. And the first click they run, it's like steal an agenda. Second click they run, I'm going to trash this thing. Third click they run, that's another agenda. And you're like, gosh, I'm hemorrhaging points out of my deck. Given a situation where it doesn't necessarily matter, I think icing up R&D is the better choice.
I guess my I know where all of these are going to be obviously extreme generalizations. One of the things I think about when I'm across from an Anarch though is that it's like less of a bad idea to put just even just like a single piece of ice in front of archives, just because they have a lot of events or card mechanics or even IDs that revolve around that server that
Right.
Shaper and Criminal don't.
Yeah, stuff like a retrieval run, or maybe they will rebirth into an
The
Omar,
Omar.
which lets them, rebirth is a card that lets them change their ID, and then they would switch to Alice or Omar, which have abilities that make runs on archives. No, I think that's smart. Something else about placing ice, Jake, you mentioned, oh, if I have an end the run ice and I'm sitting across from a Shaper, I'm going to put the end the run ice on R&D. And I like that in particular because the best place I think for end the run ice is on your is in that innermost slot. Because if you've got like three ice on R&D and they make a run, let's say that outermost piece of ice has an ice wall, you res it, it ends the run, they don't have their barrier breaker, so their run is over. They've paid basically nothing to check what that ice is. But if that ice wall is the innermost ice and they have to get through an Ichi and a shadow or something and pay a bunch of credits just to get to the innermost position and then the run ends, you're in a lot better position. So if possible, I try to put my end the runs on the innermost position.
Sometimes it comes down to luck of the draw. If you don't have any end the runs, but you still want to put ice down,
Absolutely.
you're gonna end up on the outer side. But like you said, if you have the choice, you want to put them closer in so that they have to pay through to even get to that point.
Yeah. I also think it's ideal to build servers that require all three breakers, because you know, if you have a server that's like Ice Wall, Himitsu Bako, those are all barriers, so the runner has to install one breaker, and then they don't pay very much money and they can get through that. But if you have Ice Wall, Ichi, Enigma, they have to install three different breakers in order to get through that, and it's going to take them a lot longer to get that set up. So you're buying yourself more time, I think.
Also think, something I'm still bad at as the corp, is like once the runner has all of their, at least one icebreaker per ice type down, to just like not feel super defeated. A lot of the times I'll like see that they all three have all three breakers, and I'll think like, well, this is over, because I feel like I can't score anymore. But especially if you have places where you have three or four ice in front of it, even if they have the breaker, it can still be really expensive to get through that. You still have opportunities to do stuff. It might just be shorter than it was 5 turns ago when they didn't have all three breakers down.
Yeah. I think that's the time when you want to try to play, like, advanceable traps, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because now, like, if you've got the agenda in hand, but you jam in that aggressive secretary, and they run the remote, they spend a bunch of money, and then the aggressive secretary fires and it trashes one of their programs, even if they've got another copy of that program in their hand, they still have to spend the money to install it and then get up enough money again to run that remote. And in that time, you can probably score out.
You can try and trick them. If you don't have any traps in your deck, if you have like a 1-point agenda and a 3-point agenda in HQ, you can install the 1-point double advance to make them think it's going to be a 3-point agenda, drag them through that remote, they'll steal 1 point, and then you have a scoring window if they go poor enough from running through there that you can then install the 3-point and score it out over the next 2 turns.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about hidden information, because that's kind of what we're getting into, right? How do you guys like to use hidden information, and what advice would you have for new players on how to leverage hidden information?
Well, I think part of that goes back to your point earlier. And on the runner side, don't drop your console, for example, until you're ready to use its ability, because that sort of gives away what your deck is going to do. Mm. Importing HQ interface into another faction, and there you go. Now that's sort of two of my influence points into that. So,
yeah. When I first started playing, I installed a sneak door beta, which lets you click to make a run on archives, and if it's successful, you treat it as if it were a run on HQ. I installed that on click 4, 1 turn.
Mm.
And it costs, what is that, 4 credits?
Yeah.
Yeah, 4 credits and 2 memory to install it. And because it was click 4, I never got to use that. And so the person playing Corp was like, well, I'm just going to put 2 pieces of ice over archives now, so you'll never be able to use it.
Right. Or certainly not use it efficiently.
Right. And so that was when I learned that, you know, when you have those cards that give the corp a chance to respond, you want to make sure you play them earlier in your turn so you can take advantage of them for at least a few clicks before the corp has a chance to respond.
I think that's a great example.
Hidden information is definitely something I've always been less comfortable with. And that's mostly just because I'll be like, I think I'm being sneaky. But I'm sure, like, Graham sitting across the table from me is like, this is obviously a trap. Like, I'm not going to run this card. And so, and part of that is just, like, card knowledge. And part of that is just playing a bunch of games, which I think, like, Netrunner kind of requires just to sort of get a feel for the flow and what things can happen. But on top of that, if it's, like, still something you're uncomfortable with, I'm still uncomfortable with it. Like, you're able to make, like, deck building choices or ID choices or faction choices where it's okay. Like, you can make a deck without any trap in it and still have, like, a successful corp deck out of certain IDs, right? Or out of certain factions.
Right. As far as advanceable traps go, I think the best time to use one of those is when you install advance it on your turn when you have at least 4 points. Because if you install advance a card, it looks like it's a 5-cost, 3-point agenda, right? Because your next turn, you just triple advance it to score it out. So if you're at least 4 points, you're not threatening to just score an agenda. You're threatening to win. And now the runner needs to make a very important choice on whether or not they're going to check that. So another example of why traps are really good in the late game is for a situation like that where you really force them into thinking long and hard about running that server just to prevent you from winning. You can do the same kind of thing if you're at 5 points or more. You know, if you just jam something in the remote, or if you install advanced something in the remote, it can look like a 2-point agenda. So, you know, you can, if the corp gets up to a certain threshold of points, they can start doing some pretty dastardly stuff with that scoring remote.
One of the reasons why NGO is so good, because it's an economy car that also looks like a trap, so.
Yes. And if you're wondering, NGO is found in the data pack Down the White Nile, which is a great new player purchase because it has lots of neutral corp cards that are very good. Little buying advice there for you.
A 5-3 in there is one of the best 5-3s for all corps right now. So
yeah, SSL endorsement. Get paid no matter what. You score it, it gets stolen, doesn't matter.
One of my favorite moves as the corp is, you know, if you're in a position where you're at 5 points or more and the runner is at 4 points or more, so you're not too concerned if they were to steal a 2-point agenda. So like, let's say you're playing MBN and you have Project Beal, which requires 3 advancement. What I sometimes do is I will take another asset or upgrade, install it in my scoring remote, all the agenda in an open remote, like it's another asset or something. And, you know, it depends on the situation, but I feel like a lot of times runners will feel like they need to build up their credit pool or prep with the first several clicks. And then they'll typically run on click 4 into that scoring remote if it's very taxing. So then they'll probably get all the way through and see it was just, you know, another card that they can't steal when you can triple advance to win. So it doesn't work in every situation, but it can be a nice little fake out with that hidden information of knowing where the agenda is and putting it somewhere that they would never expect.
Yeah. What do you guys do when you're flooded and you're playing as the corp and you've got 3 or more agendas in your hand?
I try to be sneaky and try to drop one and just sneak it out as if it was a economy asset or just a regular asset on the table.
Just install it naked. This isn't a 2-pointer. This is a pad campaign.
That's what I try to do sometimes.
Depending on your ID, if you're playing Jinteki, you could advance it. Doom bug because there's no ice in front of it, and so they choose not to run it. And then you can just leave it there if you don't want to score it out, and then just score it later on in the game for the win.
Right, because if you leave it there, then it looks like it was a failed trap, right?
What I actually do is not necessarily in the game that's being played, but in how I'm playing it. If I'm super flooded, sounds stupid maybe, but I actually tell myself to just relax, breathe normally, because there's a lot of visual cues that you can give the runner. So if you start getting very fidgety and you're constantly looking at your cards, picking them up, setting them down, picking them up, they're going to know you're flooded. So they're probably going to pressure HQ pretty badly. So just act like you have nothing to lose and there's no issue.
Poker face, man.
Get out the sunglasses.
It's also always possible that the runner just doesn't run archives. Like, I've lost games before where I decided not to run archives on my last turn, and like the person will just be kind, or maybe it's mean, I'm not sure. Or they'll like score their last agenda and be like, you literally would have won if you just ran archives. So it's okay to occasionally take that gamble, especially if you've, when you're building your deck, created outs for yourself. Maybe it's not in your hand. So maybe you put an agenda in archives and like spend next turn drawing twice to get your preemptive action or whatever to salvage that. But corp definitely is, when you're agenda flooded, I feel like all of our solutions have sort of an element of like gambling to it, and it's just what you feel most comfortable with.
I think one of my favorite parts about playing corp is that you are like constantly like on the edge of just like dying in a big fire. Like everything is just like, everything can be going really, really well, but if one or two things don't go your way, then all of a sudden it swings back and you're like in this terrible situation. But then maybe a couple things go your way and then it swings back, and now you're like far and away, you know, in the lead. Jake, you and I were just playing a game yesterday, and you started off, you were the runner, and you were feeling really great. You were getting your rig built up. And then after a long time of being very flooded, I finally built up a scoring remote. And then I jammed out a couple agendas back to back of that scoring remote. And then all of a sudden, like, you were broke, and I had, you were using a virus heavy rig, and I had purged a couple times. And all of a sudden, like, now things weren't looking so great for you.
Like 6 to 2 points, and then you went up to four.
And then
It
I.
got down to the point where you had this big scoring remote I couldn't get into with a double advanced card, and through my ID ability, I was able to expose it to see that it was an agenda and you were going to win next turn. So I made a Hail Mary run at R&D on click three and just happened to hit an agenda off the top of the deck to win. But I felt like that game, like I had a big advantage, and then the advantage was to you, and then it swung back just by luck, and then I ended up taking the game.
Yeah. I think that's an important lesson. There's always a chance in Netrunner, right? Like, even if things are looking real bad, you always got a chance, as long as you can figure out what your best lines of play are.
Yeah, I mean, early game with that, Graham, I would have probably said that your corp being able to come back were very, very slim, but yet you definitely had like the advantage at the end of the game there, I would have said. So that's a good point to never give up, even if things start out bad, because the game can change very quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just want to say, one thing to remember though, if you're flooded, that probably means there's a lot of good stuff about to come up from your deck. So maybe you want to double ice your HQ and leave R&D open, take that risk, knowing that there's probably nothing but ice and assets and other good stuff you need coming up.
Yeah. That's just math, right? If you've got nine agendas in your deck, but four of them are in your hand, there's really only five left in R&D, so you can take a chance.
Absolutely.
All right, well, let's move on to some general deck building tips in our next segment called Priority Construction. Okay, so I don't want to go into the nitty-gritty of how many of this card should you put in your deck, how many of that card should you put in your deck. But I'm curious as to what you guys think are really important things to remember when building. Let's start with a corp deck.
My deck is going to be, do I want to score? Do I want to kill? Play something Jake would play, just asset spam to grind them out.
Yeah, I think it's important to know what like your win condition is. I would say like pick one, which is either score out before they set up, score out through a super expensive impenetrable remote, kill them, or only ice up your centrals and fast advance or whatever. But pick one of those and do it really well. Don't do all of them.
I think some of that nuance is lost on newer players. It's like still lost on me. I wouldn't probably build a corp deck without just looking one up yet. Like the corp win condition is more specific than just I need to score 7 points worth of agendas, right? Like you can try to orient your deck to scoring that and winning like by the first 10 or 15 turns. You can orient your deck to giving you a like safer long term win condition, or you literally could just focus on flatlining than runner.
And there's combinations, right? Sometimes it's I'm gonna make a deck that scores out really fast, and if the runner tries to stop me, I'm gonna punish them for it, which may or may not result in them flatlining. But usually you only want to stick to like one or two.
Made Greg though about looking at other decks. Like when you first start out and even later on, never feel bad about, using other people's ideas and decks that they've built. There's only a finite number of cards combos you can do here. So people are definitely going to arrive at the same things. So, don't feel bad if you kind of build off of someone else's ideas, especially when you're first learning the game. It's almost impossible to just dive right in and make a decent deck without spending some time learning the nuances.
I remember, like, there was some Saturday I was going over to my buddy's house. He had, I had just bought Netrunner. He already had like some data packs as part of his collection, and we're like sitting down and we're gonna play a couple games, but we hadn't built any decks yet. So we're both like, yeah, we're gonna do some cool stuff with these new data packs we just got. And I built this 54 card Jinteki deck that probably had like 5 or 6 economy cards in it, and it was terrible because I couldn't afford to do anything, and I was so frustrated because I like didn't know why I was so broke all the time. But then I went and looked online at just other decks that use the same ID that I was using, and I would like look at the number of economy cards they had, which was usually for the corp it was like in the 12 card range, and then compare that to the number of tricks that they had, like non-ice traps and things. And it was usually like there were more economy cards than there were traps. And I was like, what? I thought it was all about the trickery. Well, you can't do any trickery if you're broke. I think that's an important Netrunner lesson.
I think when you start off, however many economy cards you think you need, just add more.
Just add more. Always put
how many you need.
What feels like too many economy cards, right?
Right. Obviously, it depends on the strategy you're going with, but the same with ice. At least for me, when I started, I was like, oh, I only need like 6 or 7 ice. They'll stop the runner.
Yeah, you need... I think for a new player, you never want to go less than like 15. Maybe.
I think that's a good number.
Yeah.
That's a good, yeah.
David, you love putting ice in your deck. You're like, I got 29 ice in this deck. What do you think?
Every time I've ever tried to play those, you know, Netrunner DB dex lists of the week that run the 9 pieces of ice, I will never draw them. So part of my ice choice is because of my luck of the draw when I tend to play a little bit more ice heavy in my corp decks because of that reason.
You know, yesterday we were talking about, I forget whose deck it was, maybe Kevin's, and he was feeling frustrated because he kept losing out of his centrals, out of HQ and R&D, and he only had 12 pieces of ice in his deck. And we talked about it. We were like, you know what? Maybe you just need more ice because, you know, even if your strategy is not all about taxing them out and making these huge servers, you still need to draw into ice early enough before the runner can get a bunch of points.
And ice you can actually res too.
Yeah, ice that you can afford. I think you ultimately, I mean, I don't know. Do you guys have any thoughts on how to feel out that level of money versus the ice that you're putting in your deck? Like, how do you know when you have too much expensive ice?
I will always err on the side of more econ if I feel like one of those two buckets has to decrease. But that's a good point about the cost of the ice, too. If you just throw in the most expensive ice you can find because it's really strong and good, you'll never be able to res enough to actually make it worth it. So you need to have that in Magic. They call it the mana curve of how much mana do you have to pay for your different cards. And if they're all on the far end, if they're all on the low end, they're not going to be powerful enough to make a late game different. So you want to have that nice curve for the early game, then the middle game where you have most of your cards, and then the really strong ones at the late game. So I try to do a similar sort of balance with the cost of the ice. But I think it also depends on your agenda density in a deck. So I actually run 9 pieces of ice in 2 of my decks. I have like 6 or 7 agendas. So the density is low enough that if I don't have ice to begin with, I'm probably not going to have a ton of agendas in HQ, and odds of them hitting off the top of R&D is very low.
I think it's a little bit more complicated than just pieces of ice. I always feel the sweet spot of ice is between 15 to 18 pieces of ice.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully you'll see impactful ice too. And as well as the breakdown of the type of ice, like I only include 3 to 5 barriers that I don't want them to cost more than 3, for example.
I find that barriers have such a low face check that the main thing they do is force the runner to find their barrier breaker, right? Here's what I don't like about, like, Hadrian's Wall, right? It's a big old barrier, 7 strength, 2 end the run subs, but it costs you 10. And if you're trying to score out behind it and the runner runs it and you spend 10 credits and you flip that up, the runner says, oh dang, the run ended. And they are no worse for the wear, right? So I think a piece of ice like Hadrian's Wall is generally very hard to use well, and debatably is not like a great piece of ice. Whereas something like Tollbooth costs 8, but when the runner hits it, they lose 3. So even though you spend a bunch of money keeping them out with that and the run sub, at least the runner didn't walk away totally unscathed.
And Tollbooth is every single time they run into it, they lose 3. So it's a really great piece of ice that's in the core set that you're going to have always be impactful. So
yeah, that's a good deck building tip, right? Like, if you need ice to score behind, put in Tollbooths. It's only 2 influence. I don't care what faction you're playing, put in Tollbooths. Really good. Whoa, did you guys see that portal open up? Wow, Ross has joined us. Ross, the famous guy from the other couple podcasts we did. What's going on, Ross?
Sup, hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. We're just talking about some general deck building tips. So let me open up another question. We've been talking a little bit about the corp side. Let's go to the runner. How do you guys choose your icebreakers?
Well, if you're Anarch, you play the Conspiracy Breakers.
Those would be all the ones from the Flashpoint cycle that install themselves from the heap. And why do you like those, Ross?
Right now, I think there's a lot of great Anarch cards that help you accelerate your gameplay that normally are a problem with trashing programs like Inject, where you draw cards but trash programs. And if you got these programs that you want in the bin, because you can then install them without needing a click. So Merc Ultra, Paperclip, and Black Orchestra, they might not be the most efficient out there, but being able to install them easily and then use them,
yeah,
makes sense.
I feel like the influence with Anarch is spent better on other cards than Breakers. Ross was saying, the Conspiracy Breakers for Black Orchestra, the Code Gate, and then the MK Ultra, the Sentry Breaker, they're very expensive sometimes and very inefficient, but they're not horrible. And so I think it's better to save the influence for other things. Paperclip, on the other hand, is the best barrier breaker in the game.
And yeah, it's the best barrier breaker in the game by a long shot, right? Like, there's a pretty stark difference between Paperclip and Morningstar or Saker or God Aurora.
Paperclip's hard to beat.
Yeah. What about in criminal decks? Do you guys like the Bird Breakers? Do you guys like the Corset Breakers? Central Breakers? You got Femmes and Fairies. What do you think?
I like Mongoose. Oh, yeah, for Sentry.
Yeah, Mongoose as a Sentry Breaker is amazing.
Do most people run a second killer to support the Mongoose? I know there's a couple different options for that, but I'm wondering what other people do. Because I have been really kind of torn on criminal.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
I think Femme, probably.
I run usually 2 Mongooses in my criminal deck because it's hard to beat that plus a Femme.
So Mongoose is a pretty efficient breaker, but you can only use it on 1 Sentry each run. So that's why we're talking about another way to support that.
Yeah.
Let's talk real quick about Femme Fatale, because it's really strong in the core set. But a new player might look at it and be like, these numbers are terrible, and it costs 9 to install, so why is it good?
The impact with the Femme is understanding that the bypass effect. In the core set, there's really only, I think, 2 cards in the core set that have a one encounter effect, which would be, I think, Tollbooth and
the Raven.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So part of the power of Femme is that you avoid that encounter effect happening, as well as paying the cost to break that piece of ice.
Yeah, so all of a sudden, you know, you install that Femme, the toll booth that was keeping you out, because it cost you like 7 to get through with a Gordian Blade or something, you put the Femme, you put your Femme counter on the toll booth, and now you can bypass that toll booth by paying 1 credit, which is amazing.
Yeah, it's real good. Especially if, because Retrieval runs in the revised core set, isn't it? So
it is.
Potentially, if you have Femme Fatale in your heap, you could install it for free, which is a great way to bypass that cost for an Anarch deck.
Right. Or you can pull it up with a test run. Those are also the revised core.
Yes, that's right.
And test run lets you search your deck for a program, install it. So if you search for Fem, you get to put that Fem counter on something. But then at the end of the turn, whatever program you install with test run goes back on top of your deck. So it's kind of a nice one-off trick of like, oh, I'm going to spend 3 credits on a test run and basically blank your toll booth and get in this one turn, which isn't great if I'm going to try to blank something on HQ and then just run your hand a couple times every turn. But it's really good if they're trying to score out behind a toll booth or even like a wall of thorns or a Hadrian's Wall.
One influence too, so it's super importable to every faction.
Fem is, yeah. Put Fem everywhere, all the time.
Only one. Never run two or more.
Unless you have credit kiting.
Oh, credit kiting is a new economy card that is debatably mediocre and situational. But it would let you install your Fem for cheap, so.
Yeah.
I haven't really played around with much with the new criminal breakers that you can like trash to bypass a matching ice one time.
Directive, yeah.
Yeah, so I did play against the deck once, though, that near the end of the game, they closed out against me that way. It kind of caught me off guard because I had all this math in my head about the scoring window I thought I had, and then I realized that they could just get in that last time when needed.
I think a trademark of a lot of criminal breakers is that they have weird pump values. It's usually like 2 credits to pump 2 strength or something like that. So my general tip with those is to pair it with like a data sucker, and then a data sucker token can, in a situation, save you like 2 credits instead of just 1, because the data sucker tokens reduce ice strength by 1 each time you spend 1. So, you know, that's a way to get around the inefficiencies of the criminal breaker suite. One pro tip I did want to say. Fairy is a one-use sentry breaker that's crazy efficient, but trashes itself after you use it. However, you can use a sacrificial construct, which is a resource that says trash this and prevent a program or hardware from being trashed. Mm-hmm. You can use a sacrificial construct to prevent the fairy from trashing itself. So you get like an extra use out of your fairy with a sacrificial construct. Fun little core set combo.
Real quick, I want to jump back to those terminal directive breakers we were talking about that have the ability to trash to bypass
yes.
a piece of ice. So I built a deck that actually uses those as backup breakers. So it mainly relies on AI breakers to get through the ice. However, if there's ever a situation where you don't have the credits, or if your AI breaker is just not able to get through, you have those installed but never really used except for that trash ability care losing it because you need to get by potentially to win the game. So they're very inefficient if you actually use them to try and break ice regularly, but they're nice kind of, you know.
Yeah, the Poke Breaker, Abigail, that one's actually a really good, the numbers on that one are actually pretty good.
Yeah, it starts at 2 strength, which I think is crucial.
Mm-hmm.
To pump up the strength?
2 for 2 strength.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now.
That's not bad. If I have the influence available, I'll always go with the Gordian Blade and Criminal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Gordian Blade is just real good all day. If you are forced to use mediocre breakers, like let's say you're playing a criminal deck and you can't use a Paperclip and a Gordian Blade, you just don't have the influence for it, I think you can build your deck to make few but high impact runs as opposed to many single access runs. You know, if you're making relatively few runs, then the inefficiencies of your breakers are like less
mitigated. Yeah.
Yeah. They're less impactful. They're less significant. So, maybe you make a deck that uses Maker's Eye and Legwork a lot, which let you see extra cards off of R&D and HQ respectively. And then maybe you put in other cards like Same Old Thing, which is from Creation and Control, that lets you play an event from your discard pile again. And so you just focus on only running those centrals when you're playing those big events.
And that's a good point for Criminal. You tend to make bigger and more impactful runs than lots of single access runs. So
Right.
Your interaction breakers do kind of represent that. Do you want to do shape icebreaker choices before we move on?
Oh, yeah. So we talked a little bit about some options for Shaper. Inti with this dedicated processor, if you don't want to use battering RAM, Gordian Blade is generally always really good. What kind of breakers do you guys like putting in Shaper?
Nanotech's been a really popular choice since that came out. It's just a good general influence-free killer.
Yeah.
Especially in the late game, gains even more strength, when they typically have multiple ice on the same server. So I've been enjoying using that one a lot.
Nanotech is in the Free Mars data pack.
A lady as a barrier breaker as well.
Yeah, she's really efficient.
You only get so
Yeah.
many uses out of it.
Yeah, using something like well, when you install Lady, you get like four counters that you can use to break barrier subs, is that right?
Yeah.
So then you can use stuff like Scavenge, which trashes a program and then lets you install a program from your heap. So you can reinstall the same program for free, and that will recharge the counters on it.
So,
What do you guys think about stealth?
love it.
Either love it or you hate it, so.
I hate it because I always lose to it every time.
So stealth breakers are breakers that use stealth credits, and stealth credits are special credits supplied by other cards. So by using stealth breakers, you have to build in support cards, but it's stuff like one stealth credit for +5 strength. Like they're super efficient, if you can afford to build around that. And probably the best ID for using stealth is in is a Smoke, because she starts with a stealth credit on her at the start of the game. You can use that once per turn. So,
Recurring stealth credit, yeah.
yeah, do you guys always include an AA breaker in your decks?
Not always, but nowadays I usually have a one or two AI breakers.
It's like a just in case thing, right?
Mostly because the Scorpios is a thing.
Yeah, Scorpios is a deck that tries to trash your breakers and remove them from the game. It's a Wayland ID from the Terminal Directive box. So having an AI breaker gives you just yet another breaker that you can use to get in before they can trash your stuff.
Just for Shaper, my AI of choice is usually I always slot two Atmans in. I think that's just one of the once the ice is resed, it can be the most efficient breaker in the game. So
Absolutely. So when you install Atman, it's an AI breaker. It can break any type of ice, but it when you install it, you pick a strength, and it can only break ice that is exactly that strength.
Data sucker is a way to get even more out of Atman, so
So you
that's
can
often
install
enough.
your Atman at like 4, and then when you hit a strength 5 ice, you use a data sucker to lower it to strength 4, and then you get to break all the subs, which is dope. Okay, sweet. Well, I have one other main beginner segment that I really want to talk about because, well, I mean, the game is all about money, right? And we're going to talk about one of the most iconic money cards that the runners have access to in our next segment, Rigonomics. So, Magnum Opus is one of the most iconic Econ cards, I think, because it permanently upgrades your click for one credit action into a click for two credits action. It costs 5 to install, and it's 2 MU, so it's kind of tricky to fit into your rig sometimes, and it's a little bit expensive, so it sets you back for a little bit of time. Math-wise, it's about as good as clicking for credits once you use it like 6 times, because you spent one click installing it and spending 5, and then you spend, your next 5 clicks gaining 10 credits. You end up at about the same point that you would have if you just spent those clicks clicking for credits. But after that, you're golden, right? It's all profit from there on out.
And it's really powerful in the late game in particular. Primarily, I've mostly seen it out of Shaper and occasionally Anarch. Being able to click for 2 credits per click feels real good if you have especially have a lot of other stuff you can do that doesn't require clicks, like free draw from cards you have in play. or cards that give you extra clicks.
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of good ways to use it, but why doesn't everyone use it if it's so good?
One, now it's on the restricted list, so you're making a deck building choice to include Opus.
I think that's a big part. If you choose one card from the restricted list, you can have any number of copies of that card, but then you can't have anything else off of that restricted list.
Yeah. I mean, if you don't take Magnum Opus, or if you take Magnum Opus, I mean, you're giving up a lot of good choices.
Yeah, there's several really good restricted options, I think.
I think as long as you just really commit to doing it and you have a game plan and how you're going to take the biggest advantage out of it, you know, I'm running it right now as my restricted choice in my Cabanisa Wu deck. And it has a lot of extra other economy options in there to make it a little easier to install and not set you too far back. It really adds a lot of power to the late game.
So, yeah, it's definitely one of those. I would still qualify it as sort of a late game economy card in that it is it costs you tempo to install it, but it helps get you to the point of that late game inevitability where the runner's guaranteed to win.
And if you only make like one run a turn or something, there's a lot of decks out there that don't run too much per turn, especially if you have a shape card like Beth Kilrain Chang that can give you an extra click as long as the corp has at least 15 credits. Mm-hmm. Now you're looking at 5 clicks. At every extra click you get is crazy good efficiency.
David, I know that you have sort of a love-hate relationship with Magnum Opus. I want to hear what's going on. What are your thoughts? Tell me everything.
I find it to be a great card sometimes, especially out of Anarch. It's amazing it because you can tutor for it with decoding.
Frantic coding, yeah.
Pop it in and shuffle all your cards back in. In Shaper, I feel like there's better economy options right now, actually.
I would love to know what you've got recommended because I've been really struggling with my Shaper economy lately. So
I just find that I think a Tapworm is actually probably one of the stronger cards for Shaper right now because you have a way to protect it and force them to lose, you know, with the Sacrificial Construct on the table to continue to give you money or give up a turn to purge to get rid of the card they wanted to get rid of.
So here's my thing about Magnum Opus. If you have Magnum Opus in your deck, I feel like you have to commit to it. The advantage is that it's basically all the money that you're going to need for the most part, so you probably don't need a lot of other slots dedicated to money cards. But that said, every click that you spend doing something that's not clicking Magnum Opus is a click that you're not spending on Magnum Opus. So if you are running all the time, I feel like Magnum Opus isn't a very good card for you because you need to be spending clicks to get your money off of it. So other cards like Daily Cast, which gets you 5 credits for 1 click, or Data Folding, which just gives you 1 credit at the start of your turn for the rest of the game, those are clickless options, basically. So I really feel like you have to adapt your strategy to Magnum Opus in order to have it as a worthwhile include.
I think that's a fair point. And I do think that there are some decks where it is a good choice. And honestly, the deck that I've been playing, my Wu deck using Magnum Opus, just runs so rich most of the game that it really solves a lot of other solutions that you might normally have to deal with. I don't have to worry about stuff being purged. I don't have anything that's really affected by that except Clot. So they can't just take away my economy engine by giving me an extra turn, you know? And yes, it costs a lot up front. You can mitigate that by using other burst economy cards like Sure Gamble or Peace in Our Time, which gives you 9 net credits. I find that if you use some of those, that once you get it down the table, it feels real good. So as long as you're finding other ways to get clickless support, like Earthrise Hotel or Astrolabe, cards that let you draw cards without needing a click, then you have those extra clicks to click for money.
I think there's another couple of advantages to using Magnum Opus. One is if you're using Magnum Opus, you're not using as much resource economy. and resources can be trashed if you're ever tagged. So you're kind of less vulnerable to being tagged in that regard, which I think is really good. And similarly, if you are ever... if you're playing against a corp that wants to drain you of your credits with their... usually their event cards, right? So something like a closed accounts, which removes all your money. Reversed accounts is an advanceable asset that they can use to remove your money.
Mm-hmm. Economic warfare, maybe?
Economic warfare also removes your money. You can recover from that stuff so quickly with Magnum Opus.
Yes.
So
I mean, that your point of resources being a little more vulnerable, I mean, you look at something like Professional Contacts. It's also 5 credits to install. Every click gives you a draw and 1 credit. So that's similar in terms of efficiency gain as Magnum Opus, depending on the deck. But if they tag you, then they could potentially trash that and really set you back.
Important thing to remember, too, is that it does cost 2 memory, which until you have ways to extend your memory, that can really sometimes hamper you. Games where I just wasn't finding my extra memory cards, whether that was my console or sometimes it's something to remember about too with that one.
Absolutely.
You have to plan for that and the install costs, and you have to protect it from things like program destruction. So
what type of deck do you think is the best deck for Magnum Opus? What strategy, like how do you play a deck to optimize Magnum Opus the best?
I mean, I can say what I'm doing with it right now that I found helpful. My Cabanisa Wu deck is a shaper deck that is really just good stuff. Make money, make runs, high impact runs. So I try to do a lot of turns in the later game in particular where I've got my full rig set up of all the main icebreaker types where I click a couple times for money and then I use a special run event that lets me access a ton of cards.
Yeah.
It has a console that gives you 2 memory instead of 1 to use the gauntlet to be able to get a lot of great multi-access on HQ, but also get extra memory. And so I have the ability to fit in my other programs, but I've added extra events and other economy cards to supplement that so that I can, you know, run on shorter economy without Magnum Opus for a bit if needed and still survive, or I can get it later in the game and be fine up to that point.
Yeah.
So that's what's, and it's been working. It's actually been doing really well.
I always tend to put it into a deck that maybe runs a slower setup.
Yeah.
But perhaps more efficient rig once it's set up, once you get past that initial install cost. So probably get by with some less efficient breakers too sometimes. Those are your influence restrictions based on what else you're putting in there. So
yeah, I think an important thing to remember with Magnum Opus is that you don't want to have a rig that has a billion moving parts. I think it works really well if you've got like your 3 icebreaker types and a couple of money cards and a couple high impact events, and that's it. So you don't want a deck that uses all these different memory chips so that you can install all these supplemental programs, because, again, all those clicks that you're installing stuff, you're not clicking Magnum Opus.
I think in an early version of my deck did not have Earthrise Hotel, and it just had, like, Diesel, and then it didn't really have much in terms of draw. I might have had Laguna Velasco District at one point, and then I was like, hey, every click I use is either going to get me 2 cards or 2 credits, which is awesome, but it felt so slow. And I kept thinking, I need these credits. I need the clicks for money. And so when I added Earthrise Hotel, which, you know, 4 credits to install resource, and for 3 turns, you get 2 free draws. That was what really ended up accelerating the gameplay and making it feel really, really good.
Yeah.
And that was the turning point with my performance with it.
One of those cards is once you install it, you're like, this is so good. It should be in every deck. So
yeah. All right. Well, guys, thanks so much for joining me.
Absolutely.
Well, if you, new player, found this helpful, leave us comments, give us a good rating on iTunes, and send this to your other friends. If you are a veteran and you want to chime in and give even more tips to the new player, please do so. And as always, please send me your suggestions for what kind of stuff you want to hear us talk about on the next episode of Shipment from Shiloh.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks a lot, Grab.
Thank you so much. You can find us at least twice a month at shipmentfromshiloh.podomatic.com. You can shoot me a tweet at GrahamCrackerGo. My username on all things Netrunner is PureFlight. Thanks to Foundation for the amazing theme music, and thanks to you for listening in. That's our show. This is Graham Carlson signing off for the night. Stay safe, New Angeles, and join us next time on Shipment from Shiloh.
I'm telling you, Graham, your podcast inspired them to do that. That Shiloh location is not a coincidence.
They could have done like Boss Wash or some other random situation. I don't know, man, because I'd only started this podcast last summer. So
that's when they started designing this expansion.
Maybe. Maybe it's not a coincidence. Hello, and welcome to our Netrunner Discord channel, where Greg and Ross and I swap ideas about Ross's Shaper decks, mostly.
It's mostly my messages saying that Ross kicked my ass, and then he posts his deck list.
Here's what I beat him with.
What do you guys think? Greg, do you have thoughts? I just beat you with this deck. Cool. Well, let's get on to a... Oh, shoot, I don't have a name for this segment here. I just have it as Revised Core Deck Building. I don't want to call it that.
That's a card title, right?
Call it White Hat or Code Replicator.
Are you just reading cards from a data pack?
I just have the three Katara data packs in front of me. So I'm looking at them.
Like Council of the Crest.
Call it By Any Means. Security through Vigilance.
In our next segment, DJ Fenris. What does that have to do with the deck building? All right, well, let's move on to some general deck building tips in our next segment called Because We Built It.
Should have been Priority Construction.
In our next segment called Priority Construction. God damn it. Whoa, did you guys see that portal open up? Ross is... let me say that again.
It's the same joke you did a few episodes ago.
Yeah, and I'm going to use the same sound effects because I don't want to find new ones. Plus, new people are listening to this and they don't know. Hey, Jake?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Great. Joining me today, I've got my buddies, Jake. Son of a bitch. I don't know what the fuck. What the heck, Discord? This is wild. This is literally the worst thing. I'm sorry. Jake's mic just died on him. Fuck me running. Are you serious? Why can't I hear Jake? Why?
He said yes, and my name lit up.
I know. I see your name light up, and I just can't hear you. Isn't that the most terrible thing?
Both
you heard
times.
Him this time. And I can't hear him? What the fuck? Well, frick, man. I don't know. It's working now. I'm literally going to stab something.
Well, Dave left.
This is the best.
This is the podcast, Graham. This is it.
This is my nightmare. Well, we got off to a great start.